Recently, an Iowa man and his sons made a huge discovery on their Oskaloosa farm.
I said, boys, that's a bone. That's a really big bone.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour today, we'll hear how scientists are in the process of excavating the skeleton of an extinct mammoth, learn what they hope to discover, and ask them for a glimpse of life in Iowa 12,000 years ago. Then a conversation with 18-year-old Carroll, Iowa native Ray Heim. We'll find out why she's running across the United States barefoot. That's all coming up right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. About 2 years ago, an Iowa farmer and his sons were out looking for berries near their home in Oskaloosa. That's when they came upon something unusual sticking out of the ground. Here's what that farmer told ABC affiliate WOI-TV.
We were on our way to a berry patch. It's on the south side of this ditch. And it was late July. It was hot. And we were just walking down through here. And both of my boys were ahead of me. And they'd walked down this path just ahead of me. And my oldest son said, there's a ball down the bottom of that ditch. And I went and I looked at it. It was about 8 foot down in the gray slip clay, which is really low. And I said, there's no ball that deep in the ground. So we walked on around this path. And I got down closer and I could see a marrow line around that ball. And I knew it was a bone. And it was a huge, huge bone. So now the only thing I could think, it had to be a mammoth, is as large as it was.
Now, for the past 2 years, that farmer and the family have kept relatively quiet about the discovery. But they recently decided to enlist the help of experts from the University of Iowa to aid in the excavation. Joining me now to discuss this mammoth discovery, the two co-leaders of the excavation project, Sarah Horgan, Education Coordinator at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Also, Holmes Semkin. He is a professor emeritus of geoscience at the University of Iowa. Professor Semkin, Holmes, welcome.
Good afternoon.
We want to reach out to our listeners if you have questions during this half hour about this find, or perhaps you've discovered something from prehistory. It does happen. Tell us about it. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. So there is an agreement between the farmer and the University of Iowa. The landowner is going only by the name of John. His name has been withheld at his request. He's planning to keep the bones, but requested from the University of Iowa help in excavating them. What is the agreement with the farmer?
Well, I first saw the bones at an artifact show, and I was very impressed with the quality of the material. And one of the table holders behind John at the artifact show said, you can trust these guys and try to work with them. And so we had a very pleasant chat, and this included an anthropologist and a geologist, another geologist. We came back home, and about a week later, he called and asked if we'd be interested, the university would be interested in excavating the mammoth. And we had had a very good experience with the Museum of Natural History excavating a giant ground sloth in southwest Iowa. And so I called Sarah and said, maybe we can get something going here again. Mm-hmm. John was very clear that he wanted to keep the bone, but he also understands that there's a lot of science associated with it. And we're as interested in the package, the sediments that surround the bone, as well as we are the bone itself, because there are details of it we can get about the past environment of the site. So I said, well, John, we'll need at least one bone. First two is a voucher specimen, so somebody can come to the museum and say, yeah, well, that is a mammoth, not a mastodon, as you said. And also, we want to do the chemistry, the bone chemistry, which will tell us very much about how the animal lived at the time it died. And so we're getting the science, and John is getting the bone.
They are his and will remain his property.
They are his and they will remain so.
Okay. So at what stage is the excavation right now? I understand, in fact, there's a dig planned for this coming Saturday.
Yes, we have had two museum-sponsored excavations to this point, and we have another planned for Saturday. We have made a few trips out to the site to do some mapping. We were out there Sunday with a small group doing some ground-penetrating radar at the site and some electronic mapping mm-hmm. of the site as well, and uncovered a few more bones at that point.
What's the total number of bones uncovered so far?
The total number of bones uncovered at this point is probably close to about 45 or mm-hmm. so. John, the landowner, had excavated approximately 35, I believe, himself, and so we've added about 10 to that total at this point.
Do we know that they all belong to the same animal?
At this point, it appears they're all from the same animal. We will see as things progress if we start finding duplicates of specific bones. That may give us a clue that there's more than one animal at the site, but at this point, it just appears there's one.
Okay, tell us about this animal, what we know of this mammoth. You said mammoth, or you said mastodon. There are different species that lived back at this time that are fairly similar, and we throw around words like mammoth and mastodon, but actually right. There are several subspecies, aren't there?
Right. Well, first, let's distinguish between mammoths and mastodons. People confuse them because they both have trunks. They both are large, immense kinds of animals weighing 6 tons or more, and they're fairly broadly distributed on the landscape during the last glacial advance. Mastodons are browsers, and they have teeth that look more like those of a pig. Mammoths are actually elephants. You're in the elephant family as opposed to the mastodon family. And when you look down on the tooth of a mammoth or an elephant, it will look like looking at the top of a deck of cards. It looks like a series of plates, vertically arranged plates. The difference between the mammoth tooth and a deck of cards is that there are three hardnesses in the cards. Hmm. And by looking at the teeth and the number of cards per unit area, you can distinguish between most of the mammoths. We have three that potentially in Iowa, the woolly. We have not have found a specimen of woolly in Iowa, but they're in Wisconsin and they're in Nebraska, so you could anticipate they would be here. There's an animal that looks called Jefferson's mammoth. It has fewer plates per unit measure than a woolly mammoth, and it's a little bit bigger than a woolly mammoth. And then we have the Columbian mammoth, which has still fewer plates per unit measure, and it is the largest of the three. If you wanted to distinguish a mammoth from a mastodon, if you were walking down the street of Ottumwa, a mastodon would have a straight back, and the head would not be domed. The tusk of an adult would be smaller. Mm-hmm. The mammoth would have a sloping back, and the head would be domed, and it would have large recurved tusks that almost cross over each other toward the front in the adult.
So which specimen do we think we have here?
I'm guessing that we have a Columbian based solely on the size of the femur.
It is a big femur. It is a big femur. How big is that femur?
It's about 4 feet, I think, mm-hmm. wouldn't you say?
Yep.
4 feet long, weighing how many pounds?
John says it's 70 pounds. I'm sure he weighed it.
Mm-hmm. And you have both examined it?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's remarkable to hold something like that, I'm sure.
Oh, it is. It is. And it's always a thrill. I've dug mammoths before, and you never get tired of it. I'm trying to keep my hands off at the dig to let other people experience digging mammoth bones. I've had my fun, and I'm having fun watching other people have fun.
How unique is this find?
In Iowa, I'm not aware of any other potentially complete specimens, because we don't know that we're going to find all of it. As you go further to the east, there are half a dozen complete mammoths, two of which are in Wisconsin. And then there are a number in South Dakota. At Mammoth Hot Springs in South Dakota, and there's some 50 mammoths that are found in there. But for Iowa, this is very unique. And what's particularly interesting about this is it's in between the specimens in Wisconsin and those in South Dakota, and it's also on not a line but a zone where the climate may have varied quite a bit. So we can predict the climate during the ice ages in South Dakota, that during the ice ages in Wisconsin. What did it look like in Iowa? I think we're going to get this out of that.
Let's talk about what you surmise was the climate back then. This is, 12,000 years ago? What did the land that we call Iowa look like then? What was the climate like?
It was a parkland. And by a parkland, think of something like a city park where there's grass growing on the ground, but there are also very tall trees. There are probably some intermediate-sized trees in there as well. And we know that because the Ice Age fauna was enriched in comparison to what we have today. At the end of the Ice Age, some 35 species became extinct. And within those species, there were browsers, there were grazers, there were omnivores, there were carnivores. And this requires a very broad-based environment. It can't be just plains. It can't be a closed forest, as we find in the East today. It has to be something very different.
Mm-hmm. And the climate was different? Warmer, perhaps?
Not warmer. In my opinion, and this is one of my favorite subjects, so you may have to cut me off here, is that the winters were not as cold, or certainly no colder than at present, but the summers were a lot cooler. And the reason for this, we have fossil muskoxen in Iowa, some of which are the same species as that living in the Arctic today. A muskoxen will do perfectly well in Ottumwa in winter. They don't have any problems there. It's that July temperature that's going to keep them out. And so we have all of these boreal and Arctic species during the ice ages, some of which are now extinct, living in Iowa. That means that the summer temperatures could not be as high. Now, I'm talking mostly about extremes.
Okay. Humans existing at this time.
Yes, we know that humans came into North America and Iowa at the end of the last ice age and would have coexisted with these animals and hunted mammoths and mastodons and the other animals at the end of the last ice age.
Are there archaeological finds, spear points among bones that we can know for sure that they did hunt these great animals?
Not in this state, but in other states there are examples of early spear points in direct association with extinct animals from the ice age.
When this animal is further excavated, the surroundings, what are the key questions for you that you'd like answered, Sarah?
Well, we would like to, as Holmes mentioned, we are looking at this specific animal and the circumstances in which it lived and died, mm-hmm. But also looking at the greater environment around it. We are taking soil samples from around the area where the bones are coming out. To look for seeds or pollen or animals or bones of small animals that may come out in there. That, you know, very small animals tell us a lot about the environment as well.
I've seen some video of this. The strata which you take this out of is kind of a gray clayish material. Yeah. What is that?
It's a something like a bog. There's a lot of organic material in it. That's what gives it the gray color. Mm-hmm. And we've actually pulled out a whole pod of a honey locust, seed pod of a honey locust out of this. We've seen logs in it. The log happens to have been a spruce log. It had been exposed for a while. John said that it had been there for some time, and we tried to section it to look at the rings. And tree rings will give you some indication of climate. It's a living tree. And we know how they grow in certain kinds of climates, the rate of growth. And there are other logs in there, I'm sure. John said he's seen them washing out on the creek. And when we get one that's not been exposed to the elements, I think we're going to get a series of tree rings that are going to tell us something about the climate in which the animal died. And we can directly relate to this mammoth.
Holmes Semkin is with us, along with Sarah Horgan. Holmes Semkin is a professor emeritus of geoscience at the University of Iowa. Sarah Horgan at the University of Iowa, education coordinator at the university's Museum of Natural History. We're talking about the discovery of mammoth bones on a farm near Oskaloosa. They have been partially excavated. There's more excavation to take place, and we're finding out what these could tell us about this. Talk a little bit about the care that is needed in the excavation process. You mentioned that there are some 45 bones thus far excavated, 35 of which the farmer, known as John, excavated himself. Is this an easy process? Can you do things wrong? Were perhaps the excavations that took place without your help, did they ruin anything?
No, John is very careful in excavating the bones. He, as you mentioned, or as was mentioned in the clip at the beginning of the show, he has an interest in natural history. He knew right away that this was a unique find, and has taken great care with his sons in excavating the bones that they have recovered to this point. We have, because the bones are deeply buried, most of the bones at this point have come out of the section of the creek that's eroding out of the creek bank or coming up from an open section of the creek. We have had a backhoe at the site to help take off some of the overburden. And so as we proceed south at the site into the deeper areas, we will be hopefully using a backhoe that at this point has been donated. Their time has been donated by Titan Machinery of Oskaloosa to help us take down several feet to the layer where the bones are. But as we get close to the bone layer, we remove the backhoe and then go with shovels and more finer instruments.
Work more tenderly.
Yes.
Now, I heard you mention an underground radar, so you can,
yes,
you have an idea of what is there before you actually do it, and you know then, okay, we're coming up on something.
Well, the ground-penetrating radar that we, Frank Weirich from the College of Engineering, the Hydraulics Lab, and also the Department of Geoscience, he's been out at the site a few times conducting ground-penetrating radar. It's not so much X-ray goggles looking into the ground as we wish it could be and
Darn.
See the outline of exactly where that skull might be. What it does is it shoots radar into the ground and takes readings, and it shows us, after filtering the information through a computer, where what we call hot spots that show up in different colors. And those hot spots are some kind of anomaly, something that's different in the ground. Now, it may be a bone bed. That's what we're hoping. The radar results that have come back so far have shown a few hot spots that we definitely want to take a look at. And we started work on that last weekend and need to do some more work on one spot in the next few digs. But it may or may not be bone. It just gives us an idea of where to look a little more closely.
It sounds like a lot of advanced technology,
yes,
aiding this excavation being provided by the University of Iowa.
Yes.
So this is taxpayer expense going to this, and these bones belong to this farmer. He could turn around and sell them for how much money?
Well, the first thing, the taxpayers are not putting any money into this. This is strictly a volunteer effort.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We built up a team of they call themselves the Sloth Rapid Response Team while we were digging the sloth.
I like that.
They love to dig. They come at their own expense in their own cars. They provide their own meals. And if they spend the night at the site, they either camp or go into the hotel. Titan Machinery is providing the backhoe. I'm providing my own gasoline to go down there and do this.
Okay.
So the university and the taxpayers are really getting a freebie here. Mm-hmm. And they're going to get a lot of information out of this, and we'll know a lot more about mammoths and Iowa paleobiology when this dig is done. So I think it's a real deal. We're out there because we love it.
What do we know about how this particular mammoth died? You said it was a boggy area.
Yes, the preservation is very good, and that means that the bones did not lie out in the air very long. Otherwise, oxygen would take them apart.
They sunk into something.
They sunk into the water, protected it, and the fact that there was a lot of organic material in the water that made for a reducing kind of environment, and this also protected it. The animal did lay out on the ground before it was buried for a period of time.
How do we know that?
The bones are not articulated in the first thing. You might find a rib next to a foot bone, and if it died, you would expect to be more in order than it is. The second thing we've seen is that there are at least two sizes of carnivores have had breakfast on this beast. One was something, maybe a weasel, perhaps an otter, chewed into the shin bone and actually cut and started working on the marrow. And there was a pocket in the shin bone. He was just tunneling down the length of the shin. And you can see the tooth marks on the hole that he dug to go in. I say he, it could have been she.
Okay.
And then one of the ankle bones that we found had the a mark of a large carnassial on it. And we're talking something like a lion. It wouldn't be a saber tooth, but something the size of a lion.
Okay, Don is joining us from Woodward on the line. Don, I have the information here. Welcome to a program that you are a member of the Rapid Response Sloth Team.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. It's great to hear Sarah and Holmes. You guys are doing a great job today. I've had the pleasure of working with Holmes for darn near a decade now, and with the mammothsite, one of the really most exciting things for me is having the young people there to see the spark of excitement. It's just really great to have the young people there getting dirty in the mud and just absolutely ecstatic when they find and actually excavate a mammoth bone. It's just like a veil is lifted and the kids are just astounded. And it's, to me, to watch this happen is just great.
Okay. But Rapid Response Sloth Team member Don from Woodward. I hope you have T-shirts because I'd like to wear something with that on it. Don, thank you.
Thank you.
A cap.
Okay, you've got a cap.
Yes.
You have one with you, Holmes. All right. So to wind up here, let me go perhaps to the fantastic. Any possibility of finding mammoth DNA here?
We hope so. If the mammoth is as young as I think it is, and I predicted very poorly with the sloth, it turned out to be much older than I thought. But the preservation of the bone is such that I'm very confident that we'll get DNA. We'll get collagen. This will permit us to get radiocarbon dates on the bone. Yeah. We can compare the bone date with the radiocarbon dates taken on the plants.
Do you read Michael Crichton novels or see films based on his novels?
Afraid not.
Okay. Jurassic Park.
That must
mean something. So I'm going with the DNA.
I've seen Jurassic Park. I couldn't resist that.
Could we possibly, we have just a minute here left for you, speculate, could we possibly bring a mammoth back to life?
I think not. This pops up from time to time, primarily in the Soviet Union. I have then Soviet colleagues, and they were sitting around having some vodka, having a good time, and started talking about reconstituting a mammoth. Maybe able to reconstruct some of the DNA, but I don't think you're going to get a mammoth.
Okay. Very good. Quickly, any advice you have for people who think they find something in their yard and on their land? Because this does happen, doesn't it, Sarah?
This does happen periodically. We have inquiries a few times a month from people who find something strange on their land, a fossil or a weird bone. You can certainly contact the Museum of Natural History. You can search for us on the University of Iowa website and send us pictures, give us a call. We can certainly do our best to help you identify what you find, and that is one of my favorite parts of my job. So.
This is fascinating. I hear the excitement in your voices, and there's more excitement to come. I hope you'll come back for an update as
certainly.
You continue the excavation. Sarah Horgan and Holmes Semkin, they are two co-leaders of the excavation project of these mammoth bones, a skeleton found near Oskaloosa. Sarah is education coordinator with the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History. Holmes is the professor emeritus of geoscience at the University of Iowa. Holmes and Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
When we come back, we're going to have a conversation with an 18-year-old Carroll, Iowa native. Her name is Ray Heim. She is running across the United States, across the entire coast-to-coast length of the United States. Not only that, she's doing it barefoot. And we'll find out why when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we have Ray Heim with us in our studio in Des Moines. She is an 18-year-old native of Carroll, Iowa, and has set a pretty ambitious goal to run barefoot across the country this year. She started out in Boston, Massachusetts, and is planning on ending up in Huntington Beach, California, and she has reached Iowa. Good afternoon to you, Ray.
Good afternoon.
Tell us, how did you get the idea to do this?
Well, I met somebody back in October who had ran across the country back in 2008, and I started to read his book, and he just kind of inspired me to do that.
Do you know his name?
Marshall Ulrich. He holds the master's record for running across the country in 52 days.
Mm-hmm. What about this idea intrigued you most?
I was just kind of looking for a bit of an adventure, I guess. I was going to graduate early, And I just felt like I needed to do something with my time, I guess.
So. Mm-hmm. And you've been a runner up to this point?
Yeah, I started running the summer after my freshman year.
Mm-hmm. You're doing this for a cause. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm doing it for an organization called Souls for Souls. Every dollar that gets donated to the organization, a child will get a pair of shoes, and 55% of those shoes stay here in the U.S., and then the rest go to 128 other countries.
So you started out in April in Boston, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about some of the highlights of your trip so far, your run across the U.S.
Well, the main highlight is probably just meeting all of the different people that I've met along the way because I've been staying with host families every single night. So meeting everyone has been really fun. And then talking to a couple schools along the way has been really great, too. And just so, yeah. And then I really also loved going to Philly and seeing all that.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the host families. How are they lined up?
Well, my mom's in charge of all of the logistics along the way, so they're like friends of hers and then friends of their friends and then just connections through like friends of friends of friends.
In fact, your mother is in the studio with you in Des Moines.
Yes.
Leslie Heim is with us. Hi, Leslie.
Hi.
Were you a fan? Were you on board with this idea of your daughter's right from the beginning?
No.
Okay. Tell me the scene. Did she come home one day and say, "This is what I'm going to do, Mom"?
You know, I'm pretty busy, so I'm not always paying attention to everything that gets said to me at the moment that it's said. But Ray says that she emailed me initially to tell me she was going to do it. So she emailed me, and I should let Ray tell that story, actually.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was sitting in class one day, and I'm reading the book. And then I get the idea that I want to run across the country. So I just emailed my mom, and I said, "Hey, Mom, do you think I could run to San Francisco?" And she emailed me back, like, "Why do you need to go to San Francisco? Like, you could fly there." But
after that, she actually really started to get serious about doing it. And I was not on board just because of the logistics and how much it was going to entail. It wasn't that I didn't want her to do it, which I was behind her doing it. I just didn't think it was possible that we could do it and put it together in a period of 4 to 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
And but finally, when I realized she wasn't backing down, I climbed aboard the train, and I haven't looked back.
Right. Those of us who are parents of teenagers know that impulsiveness belongs to this age group, and what you may want to do 1 week, you may not want to do the next week. So you thought it might be, oh, well, this will just fade, huh?
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and she as it got closer, she was clearly determined to do it. And we just said, okay, well, let's figure it out and line everything up. And it all seemed to have worked out so far.
Right. Ray, you are running barefoot across the country. Why barefoot?
Well, about a year ago, I broke my big toe and I had to have that toenail removed on there so it could heal properly. And once I did that, it was just super uncomfortable to wear shoes. And so I just – and I was training for a marathon, so I had to continue running. So I just was like, well, I guess I'm going to have to run barefoot. And then once my toe healed, I tried to put shoes back on, and it was just uncomfortable to wear shoes because they felt like weights on my feet. So I just stayed barefoot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought that tying my barefootness into Souls for Souls was a good idea because it's like I'm running barefoot so other people don't have to.
Mm-hmm. So actually, when you're not running, are you also barefoot? You say shoes hurt your feet all the time?
No, just when running.
Just when running, okay.
I do enjoy shoes.
So isn't though, even though you feel better running barefoot, isn't there a greater chance of injury should you step on something?
Well, I guess if you step on something like extremely sharp, there is a greater chance of injury. But my feet are so calloused now that if I step on anything, nothing really pierces the skin. And I've also haven't really had any serious injuries since mm-hmm. becoming barefoot. So,
mm-hmm. What do you worry most about for your feet?
The heat. When it's super hot out, I have to put on a pair of toe socks just to give them a little bit of protection from burning.
Mm-hmm. Some black pavement. A nice sunny day, black pavement,
yeah.
And that's
yeah,
difficult.
The highways are really awful when it comes to that. So,
how would you describe your feet at this point, several months into this venture?
Well, I've heard they're not as bad as they should be, but they're pretty calloused up and tough, so.
You've heard they're not as – don't you look at them yourself?
Well, yeah, but I just think that they're like my normal – barefoot running feet, but everyone else, like, I think assumes that they're going to be, like, super, like, mangled and ugly, but I guess they're not.
Mom, you've looked after these feet for many years. What do you think of the feet?
Well, you know, they're feet. And her feet are actually in really good shape, and it's remarkable. The first day out of Boston, Ray had been pretty lofty in her goals as far as the mileage that she could run. And so she ran 44 miles on day one. On day two, she ran about 38. And day three, she ran 32. So she had a chunk of mileage underneath her feet. And her feet looked horrible. It looked almost like she had a sixth toe because they were so swollen. But now she's got her mileage under control. She's running about 20 to 22 miles a day. And her feet actually look pretty doggone good.
Mm-hmm. Has there been a day so far when you thought, I can't do this, Ray? You thought my feet or whatever, my mental condition, you get up every day to do this 20-some miles a day. You thought this was a little bit of an overstep.
Well, there's always those days, but definitely the fourth day was the worst. Like, I was ready to throw in the towel by the fourth day.
What happened that day?
I was just so overexhausted from all of the crazy miles that I was doing, and I, like, probably 6 miles into my run that day, I was on the side of the road bawling my eyes out, like, and I had to call my mom and have her talk me back into it because I was just ready to give up. Mm. It was terrible.
You did. And Leslie, when you received that call, what happened? Tell us about that.
That was a really hard day. It actually kind of chokes me up a little bit even thinking about it because I actually believe that she can make it to the finish line. And she's a pretty determined kid. And I knew that she was physically exhausted, but I also knew she was going to be. And when she set up her mileage, I knew I had sort of allowed her to set herself up for failure a little bit. But I knew that she had to fail that first week in order to convince her she had to get it settled down a little. And so I never said, it's okay, honey, if you want to stop right now. I just said to her, you know, let's just, you know, take a minute. And I had a girlfriend that I row with that is actually in her 70s. She's like a grandma, and she's fabulous, Maxine Shepperton. And Maxine picked up Ray off the side of the road and took her to her house in Connecticut and just fed her and gave her a pedicure and babied her and let her rest, gave her some good rest, didn't bug her about running too much. And then the next day, Ray and I talked about it and just cut her mileage way down and gave her 3 days on, 1 day off, 4 days on, 2 days off. And from then on, she had a breath. You know, she could take a breath and see the light of day at the end of every day.
If you just joined us, my guests this half hour are Leslie Heim and Ray Heim. Ray Heim is an 18-year-old native of Carroll, Iowa, running barefoot across the country this year. Started out in April in Boston. They're going to end up in California. When will that be, Ray?
Probably around the first week of November.
I understand, Ray, that early on you were running and pushing a baby jogger. This was the way you designed to keep your clothes, your water.
Yeah.
But now you switched to a backpack. Why?
Yeah, about 3 weeks ago, I switched over to a backpack. The front wheel of my stroller, it like was breaking, and it was just more of a pain than anything to push it. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to ship my stroller back home. And some of the people I was staying with, they were from Souls for Souls, and she had an extra backpack, and was like, you can have this if you'd like to. And so, so for the past 3 weeks, I've been carrying about a 15-pound backpack, and I'm done with that now. Once I get back to Carroll, I'm definitely switching back to the stroller. But
Okay. And Leslie, you are following in what capacity? Where are you? Are you with her side at her side all the time or not?
No, I'm not with her at her side every day. But somebody's close by at all times. I've had sections of the run where I've been able to join up with her. I have a big family and have to go to work like everybody else does. So all the host families have kind of been our link to Ray along the way. And she has a GPS unit that she carries that we monitor with. And so we can keep track of her every 3 seconds it tells us where she is, which can you imagine most teenagers would not appreciate.
Would not permit that. No way. Is that just for family, or can people track you? I know you have a website, Ray. If you want to mention that, go ahead.
Yeah, my website is flavors.me/RayAinsley.
Mm-hmm. And we can follow you on that website, perhaps not every 3 seconds like Mom can. But
yeah, well, we keep it updated enough, like the Facebook page stays updated so that we kind of keep everyone in the loop of how I'm doing. But yeah, I don't – like we don't keep like my exact location anywhere, just for safety reasons, obviously.
So you've dialed back the miles per day from 40-some those early days. How many miles in a typical day?
I average about 20 miles now. Lately, I've been kind of actually averaging about 26, but –
And for most of us mere mortals, 20-some miles in one day, we would be on the couch or in the bed for the next 3 days. But not you. How do you feel after 20 or 26 miles a day?
I guess my body's just become accustomed to it. Like, the first week was definitely a big shock to it. But once I got past that first week, it just kind of, yeah, I just got accustomed to it, I guess. So that's just how I get through it.
You've gone through not only rural areas, but I understand into some bigger cities, New York City, Philadelphia. Yeah. What's that been like?
Going into New York and Philadelphia was a little bit scary. Those were probably the two times where I questioned my safety, because going into New York City, I was staying with my mom's friends that night, and they had created like a route to help me completely bypass the Bronx and Harlem area and but take me still into the city.
Mm-hmm.
But on my way into New York, I got completely lost that day, and I took a wrong turn somewhere, and I ended up right in the Bronx. So I was running through the Bronx for quite a long time that day, and then I ran straight into Harlem as well. So,
mm-hmm. And what were the reaction of the people who saw you?
There was parts of the areas where I just got, like, dirty looks and, like, I don't know. But I saw a couple drug busts and heard a few gunshots. But there was also some people that were like, yeah, you go, girl, because, like, on the side of my stroller it says I'm running across America. So, but, like, I got some positivity going through there. But then there was also obviously the negativity, too. So.
Mm-hmm. Do people ever run with you?
Yeah, there's been a couple times where people have ran with me. Like, my mom, whenever she's with me, she'll either bike beside me or run beside me. A friend of mine, Brenda, she ran about 18 miles with me the other day into Iowa City. And then there's been a couple people along the way that have just, like, rode their bikes along with me, too. So
what are you doing just to busy yourself mentally while you're running?
Occasionally I'll listen to music, but, I mean, there's always something interesting to see. So it's never really boring, I guess. So
So you get to take notice of the landscape and also things alongside the road. Any surprises you've seen alongside the road? Like, what is that doing here?
Not really. I'm usually pretty prepared for everything. I mean, probably the biggest surprise along the way was New Jersey. Like, I say that a lot, but it was pretty shocking because you hear a lot of things about New Jersey. But I just assumed they were all kind of just like over-exaggerated myths. But literally, as soon as you cross from New York City and New York into New Jersey, it's like this terrible smell. And the people driving are rude and like flipped me off and yelled really mean things at me the whole way. It was pretty shocking. And then the funny thing is, as soon as you cross into Pennsylvania, people are nice again.
You're not making this up.
I'm not making any of it up. None of it. I couldn't make it up if I tried.
I guess good training for this might have been watching The Sopranos then, huh? what about the weather? There's probably been some harsh weather along the way.
I've been blessed. There's only been about maybe 4 or 5 days where it's even rained a little bit. So, like, it's been pretty sunny and nice weather. I mean, it's been pretty hot the past couple weeks, but obviously it's the Iowa summer. So
right. And you're used to that growing up in Carroll.
Yeah.
Now, I understand that you encountered Jesper Olsen. And for those who are not runners, Jesper Olsen is an ultra distance runner. He's run around the world, in fact, in 2004 and 2005. You just happened upon him.
Yeah. Well, actually, right now he's running across the world for the second time as well. He should be done pretty soon once I get to Carroll. So. But, I was going south as he was going north, and we met up somewhere in Connecticut. And it was like the perfect time because it was like my ninth day into the run. So I was still like extremely tired, really unmotivated at that point. And he was super unmotivated too. So we met each other and we just kind of lifted each other's spirits up and had like a really great talk because it was really great just to talk to somebody who got exactly what we were feeling
right,
at that time.
Right.
And so, yeah, it was really, really fun to talk to him.
So what is the bigger challenge, the mental or the physical challenge of this?
Definitely the mental challenge, just because pretty much the whole time I'm staying with strangers that I know. And, like, everyone I've met has been so awesome, but it's still a challenge to be away from my sisters and my mom and just to wake up every morning and be like, hey, you have to go run 20 miles tomorrow. And that's really difficult. Like, my body's accustomed to it now, so the physical part isn't that difficult. It's just talking myself into running the miles and being away from my favorite people for so long, you know what I mean? So
the next big stop will be your hometown in Carroll.
Yeah.
You plan to arrive there when?
I'll be there on July 1st.
Mm-hmm. What's going to happen there?
I'll just be able to see my grandma and grandpa. I decided that's going to be my ending point that day. I'm just going to run straight to their house and go see them, and then I'll see my dad and my sister Delaney and my friends there, so that'll be fun.
And Leslie, can you tell us anything about the stop in Carroll?
Oh, she's just really been looking forward to it. It's probably been the one thing that's kept her going the last little bit. And her grandpa actually was diagnosed with cancer while Ray was on the run, so it's going to be pretty good to go see them.
Mm-hmm. What's in the future for you then? Do you think you'll, as Jesper Olsen has, set the next site after crossing the United States? Of course, we want to accomplish this goal first, right, Ray?
Yeah, definitely. Like, my next step is to get to Huntington Beach still, but I'm still thinking about what's next, and I'd like to go to college probably the following fall. But like my next big challenge that I want to do once I get to Huntington probably is to run down the West Highland Way in Scotland, because my granddad, a couple years before he died, he ran down the West Highland Way, and I just think I want to do that kind of like in honor of him. So I think that'd be fun.
Now, once you get past Carroll, you'll be heading into eastern Nebraska at some point, into Colorado, and then into the Rockies. Do you anticipate the Rockies to be perhaps the biggest challenge?
Yeah, they'll definitely be a big challenge, and we're still kind of figuring out the route through how to get to Huntington Beach as well. We're not sure if we want to go just straight down to New Mexico and over, or what we're going to do with that. So. Mm-hmm.
How does that change it when the terrain is not as flat as here in Iowa for you as a runner?
Well, the altitude is going to change it up a lot, because I'll have to, like, knock down my miles and, like, probably just do, like, 15 a day usually. So,
mm-hmm. So the feet have taken a beating. they are still holding up. Any other parts? Of course, runners always typically have knee or ankle problems. Any of those surfacing?
The first week was really rough on my body. Like, I did something to my Achilles, and my right foot I had twisted a bunch of times, and my knees were killing me. But nothing since then has really been a big problem. Like, I mean, once I started using the backpack, it kind of took a toll on my knees a little bit, but nothing from the initial running has actually injured me too badly.
So many people listening are undoubtedly were wowed by this accomplishment, this feat that you're doing here. When a lot of us say, "Well, should I walk to work? Should I bike to work?" and that's a real challenge. And you are going across the United States barefoot, running across the United States. How many of us do you think are capable of doing this?
I mean, I think everyone's capable of setting a goal for themselves, and if they work hard enough for it, they can accomplish it. It's pretty much just a mental thing, you know, and you have to, like, we all have our mountains to get over, and this is mine right now. So I think that maybe not everyone wants to run across the country, but I think everyone has something that they want to accomplish in their lives, and I think that they all have the ability to do that as long as they try to do it.
So remind us again about the cause you're running for Souls, and how people can find out more.
Yeah, you can Google Souls for Souls, which is SOLES, #4, SOULS, and then my name, Ray Heim. And you should be able to get to the donation page from there.
We wish you well arriving in Huntington Beach, California, approximately when?
About the first week in November.
Tell us again how we can track you online.
You can go to my. You can just Google Ray Heim, and it should come up as my main website.
That's R-A-E and Heim, H-E-I-M. Ray and Leslie, thank you very much, and
no
good
problem.
Luck.
Thank you.
Don't stop me. Don't stop me. Don't stop me.
Hey.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.